This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm back on the air today after a wonderful maternity leave with my new son, Dullin. I've enjoyed being a listener for the past 3 months, hearing Vermont Edition with new ears, and I want to extend a heartfelt thank you to Rick Singeri and Nina Keck, who hosted the show in my absence, and to Bob Kinzel, who added programs to his busy schedule. Thanks as well to the show's producers, who always keep the train on the rails. But I am so thrilled to be back in the host chair, so thrilled I'm getting verklempt, and I'm ready to continue the conversation with all of you. So let's just go ahead and get started. Today, we're going to talk about a difficult subject for many, eating disorders. Eating disorders don't just affect teenagers, but that's often where they're most visible. Disordered eating can take many forms, from anorexia and bulimia to a newly labeled disorder known as binge eating disorder. Finding treatment for a problem with disordered eating can be difficult in Vermont. There are few treatment centers focused on this problem, so those struggling often get medical treatment from doctors and mental health practitioners who may not be specially trained in eating disorders. Today on the program, we're joined by guests with experience and expertise in treating people with eating disorders, and we want to open the discussion to those of you out there with questions about your own struggles or worries you have about friends and family. How do you know when bad eating habits or excessive dieting flips into a disorder? What's the difference? And what kind of treatment can help? What do you do if you have a sneaking suspicion that someone you love has a problem? You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211 with your questions. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Here in the studio with me today is Bree Greenberg-Benjamin, founder and director of the Vermont Center for Integrative Therapy in South Burlington. Welcome to the program, Bree.
Thank you.
And joining us by phone is Dr. Marcia Heron. She is the author of The Parent's Guide to Eating Disorders. Dr. Heron is also a private practice practitioner treating eating disorders in Lebanon, New Hampshire, and she's the founder of the Dartmouth College Eating Disorders Prevention, Education, and Treatment Program. Dr. Heron, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. You can call me Marcia.
All right, I will. Bree, let me start with you, though. You treat a lot of people with eating disorders and talk to them a lot and help them get through this. How do you tell the difference, or how does one who's going through it tell the difference between, say, a very restrictive diet and a disorder? What's the difference?
Mm-hmm. There's a large continuum between dieting behavior and disordered eating, and then a full-blown eating disorder. Sometimes it can get really fuzzy to figure out where people fall on that continuum. But essentially, the key question that I ask people is, how much time is this taking up in your mind? So if you're dreaming about it, if you're spending all day planning about what you're going to eat, what you're not going to eat, how your body looks, how your clothes are fitting, if you're exercising and missing key elements in your life in order to exercise, those are things that we look for to show kind of where people fall on that continuum.
Marcia, though, it's thinking specifically about, say, teenage girls, which is often what people think about when they think eating disorders, although we'll talk about the fact that it's not just teenage girls. But thinking about teenagers, they are often obsessed with how they look, how they appear to others, what their clothes look like on them, how fat they are. Does my butt look good in this? I mean, if that's such an obsession among so many teenagers, how do you, as Bree is saying, figure out when it's a problem?
Well, our current understanding of where eating disorders come from is that it's genetics. Genetics, which means that anyone that practices these behaviors is at risk for it developing into a more serious eating disorder. And so that means if you're a parent of a teenager who's starting to go down this path, you might want to intervene before it would be classified as a real problem, because your child could be at risk. What seems to trigger the genetics is going on a diet or over-exercising, which, in fact, most adults do and most kids who have these concerns do. So early intervention before it's a classic eating disorder in teenagers is what I recommend.
This isn't just a teenage problem, though, Bree. It can affect other people as well.
Yeah, we're seeing cases as young as 10 years old and as old as women in their 50s and 60s who, you know, have been struggling since the time they were young girls, but treatment wasn't available. So if somebody is in their 50s now, you know, when they were 12 or 14 years old, this wasn't talked about at all. And so now they're finally starting to seek treatment, but have been struggling for sometimes 30 or 40 years.
Is it ever the case where an eating disorder is triggered later in life, where somebody is 30 or 40 and suddenly develops a disorder?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I have a couple patients who I'm seeing right now who are in their 40s who did not have this as a childhood disorder at all. Sometimes it can be triggered by something like acute illness. So somebody gets like mono, or they get sick for some other reason. They lose a whole bunch of weight, and then it's very hard for their mind to deal with the regaining of that weight. They kind of get stuck in that place. And I always talk about this as kind of the perfect storm. You know, I think it's many conditions coming together that predispose somebody, but it's also many conditions coming together that really make it turn into a full-blown disorder.
Those patients who perhaps have been sick or who have lost a lot of weight and then suddenly struggle with returning to a normal weight or seeing themselves gain weight, how much of that is based on what they're seeing reflected back at them from our culture? Or is it something that is more internal and more sort of mentally driven?
Boy, I wish I knew the answer to that question. You know, I think it is so hard to separate out what's external and what's internal for all of us. Our culture is so embedded inside of us these days, in our beliefs, our values, our understanding of the world. And we're barraged with it, especially people who are pretty young, from teenagers to their 20s. You know, they're deeply embedded in these cultural roots of beliefs. And so I just think it's very hard to say what is external is sometimes internal. And what I see over and over again is that eating disorders are largely people who don't have a fully developed internal sense. And so they're almost more vulnerable to the external, because that inner sense of who they are and that groundedness, it just isn't present.
Dr. Herron, would you agree?
I absolutely would, and I keep going back to the genetics would explain. We're seeing differences in people's brains. The studies are really fascinating, but they explain all this, why some people would be more at risk than others if they got sick and lost some weight, or they're a teenager in a clique that is really focused on appearance. And what matters really is what we do with this. We probably will be debating for the rest of my career, you know, is it the culture? Is it genetics? Is it this? Is it that? In some ways, those are interesting questions. And for each person, their story is different and their needs need to be met. And I know one of the things we want to talk about today, what are the treatment resources in our area and what are the lacks?
Mm-hmm. Before we get into that, though, when you talk about genetics and genetic markers, can you go a little deeper into the science? What are we finding about what might trigger somebody who is dieting to go towards an eating disorder when somebody else who's facing the same cultural pressures or school pressures might not?
Well, they call it epigenetics, which is fascinating. It would mean that there are some people who are genetically at risk for developing an eating disorder if there's an epigenetic trigger. And epigenetics basically means behaviors or things in the environment that turn on or off certain genes. And you can see why an eating disorder would be as I love Bree's perfect storm, because I agree with that. So if you're genetically at risk, you happen to get sick because you have mono, the eating disorder gets triggered. You probably naturally, along with this, have a high metabolism, able to go without eating for a long period of time, like feeding other people more than yourselves. All these things are turned on just by the weight loss or going on a diet or getting into a heavy exercise program. You know, the other evidence that there is something genetic is, though everybody's story is different, people with eating disorders, there are similarities that are just striking. These people don't know each other. I struggled from an eating disorder in the 60s growing up on a Montana ranch. I didn't have very much culture going on, but I ended up with what I learned later was a classic eating disorder that really seemed to come from somewhere else.
We're talking today about eating disorders. We're learning a little bit more about how they present themselves and what kinds of people are susceptible to them. Listeners, if you have experience that you'd like to share, you can send us a note right to vermontedition@vpr.net. Or you can call with your questions about what the signs are or what kind of treatment is available. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. Neville is calling in from Montpelier. Hi, Neville. Go ahead.
Hi there. Hi, Jane. Hi, Bree. I'm 60 now, and in my 20s, for 25 years, I was bulimic on and off, in recovery now for 10. But my experience, I wouldn't say I was as concerned about my weight, although it did go up and down a good bit. It was more about having a relationship with having the comfort of food and specifically sugar.
Mm.
So that was really, I see it just like an addiction to any other drug.
Neville, did you find when you reached out for help that it was available to you?
Yes, it was. It took a long time because when I started, I just didn't have a clue that anyone else out there was experiencing something like that. So, years and years later, lo and behold, this was fairly common. And eventually I connected with a 12-step group, you know, and I realized, I was willing to look at some of the underlying stuff. Family trauma, you know, losing my dad and my brother early on. So, you know, once the distraction of the behavior was kind of set aside for a moment anyway, then the work began. And with help from friends in OA, that's Overeaters Anonymous, and with some very patient and willing friends, it changed. And what's amazing to me now, I look back and I realize how convinced I was of being caught and having no possibility of coming through it. It's my life is, you know, food is not an issue for me now. I mean, I can overindulge occasionally, but it's cool. I have a life, so.
Oh, Neville, I'm so glad to hear that, and it's wonderful to hear from somebody who is in recovery and has that hope that you express and that ability to say food isn't an issue anymore. Because I know for so many people, it's really hard to get to that point. Bree, another thing that Neville's call brings up is that a lot of times people do associate eating disorders with anorexia or bulimia in teenage girls. Now, Neville said he developed it, I think he said, in his 20s, and he's a man. So can you talk a little bit about the different demographics and how that might be difficult for somebody who is an atypical or not stereotypical sufferer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think for those cohorts that fall outside of that, it's really hard because they sometimes stay outside of the fray and don't seek treatment. I was really glad to hear that he had the courage to go seek help. We'll kind of occasionally get the trickle in of men, teenage boys as well as older men, but it's definitely not the majority of folks that we get. And some studies that I have seen have, you know, put male anorexia and male bulimia and even male binge eating at a pretty high rate, but the shame kind of keeps them out of really getting counted. The other really difficult thing is that when men come in for treatment, they're often in treatment groups with all women. So there's some specific issues that pertain to males struggling with eating disorders that they don't get in a women's group. And then conversely, sometimes it can be hard for women to have a male person in their group, especially because lots of times this is co-occurring with sexual abuse and other types of trauma in their past. So it can be really tough to be able to mix those. But currently that's what treatment looks like because there's no separation.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about that in just a moment, what treatment looks like and what is available to people in our region who are struggling with disordered eating. Again, listeners, if you have experiences to share or questions, you can post them on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're looking at how eating disorders are treated and why it can be difficult to find appropriate care in our region. It's often difficult as well to tell when the right time to seek help is. If you've dealt with these issues yourself or in your own circle of friends or family, you can let us know how you addressed your concerns. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or join the conversation on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Our guests today are Dr. Marcia Herron, a private practice practitioner in Lebanon, New Hampshire. She's also the author of The Parent's Guide to Eating Disorders, and Bree Greenberg-Benjamin, who founded and directs the Vermont Center for Integrative Therapy in South Burlington. We got a note from Judith who says, I've had an eating disorder for 30 plus years and have found recovery through Overeaters Anonymous. There are now phone meetings, some of which are extremely helpful to me. We heard about Overeaters Anonymous as well from our caller, Neville. Dr. Herron, Bree was mentioning before the break that often group therapy is one of the most prevalent ways that people who are dealing with an eating disorder get treatment. Could you talk a little bit about what that looks like?
Well, group treatment requires a certain population of patients in an area, and there certainly is group treatment in the Burlington area through Bree's center. But in most of Vermont and New Hampshire, and I see patients in Vermont and New Hampshire, it's just not possible because we all live in little towns and you need a population base for group treatment. Bree mentioned some of the downsides of group treatment. So it's not the end all. In some ways, it's the most economic treatment because you could two providers and a number of patients. But most treatment in rural areas is provided through team treatment, a physician, a therapist, and a nutritionist. And if at least one of those members of the team is well-experienced, we can do really good work with that kind of model, and that tends to be what we've been using in rural areas of Vermont and New Hampshire.
Are enough people trained and skilled in dealing with eating disorders?
We could use more, that's true. And I have, we're low in nutritionists who are trained. There's one or two in Vermont and one or two in New Hampshire, and patients often have to drive, and their families, I have patients that come several hours to see me. But if we're doing a really good job, we get the job done, and then they're back to their regular life and support more locally with the therapist and the physician. And that's a model that's actually worked well for me and my patients.
And Bree Greenberg-Benjamin, you are a nutritionist, is that right?
No, I'm a psychotherapist.
So what about that piece of it, the nutrition part of it? Because obviously this is an issue with food, but it's also an issue with control. As you said, there are often co-occurring other disorders, mental disorders that go along with this. So how do you fit all those pieces together to find effective treatment?
Ironically, that's how I founded the center. It was because prior to that, in working with eating disorders as a solo practitioner, it was incredibly frustrating to try and put those teams together. So I founded a place where all those people live under one roof and work together as a team for folks. But we're an unusual situation. You know, most people, as Marcia said, you know, either they live in more rural areas or there isn't a center like ours. And in order to get really team treatment, a model like that, they have to go to a higher level of care, like residential care, which is going to be out of state. So we do it really well, but that is definitely the anomaly.
And you think there needs to be more treatment options available for people around the state and around the region?
Oh, my gosh, absolutely. I mean, right now, as it stands, we get about 5 to 10 calls a week for people who need a higher level of care and are desperately looking for it. And Boston is kind of the closest place for people to go.
So that's true.
So if you need help, you have to go out of state, if you need inpatient treatment.
Even if you need outpatient treatment, but at a higher level of care, like an intensive outpatient program or a partial hospitalization program, all of those you have to go out of state. And when you consider the fact that you may have parents who have one child with an eating disorder and another who doesn't, then those parents have to travel out of state to be there for the family work for their daughter who's in the inpatient program. It's really difficult on families here,
and
quite expensive.
We should say as well, we spoke this morning with the Brattleboro Retreat, which does help people with eating disorders in its adolescent treatment programs, outpatient and inpatient, but that's not a specific treatment program for eating disorders.
That's correct. And there's another IOP locally who does service some folks with eating disorders, but again, it's not eating disorder specific.
IOP.
Intensive outpatient program. Yep.
We got a question, actually, or a comment from a listener named Benjamin about this issue and leaving state and insurance. And Benjamin says, when my 12-year-old daughter had to be hospitalized for her anorexia, we brought her to an inpatient program in Waltham, Massachusetts. We were grateful that Vermont Medicaid would pay for her acute care, but we were frustrated that there was no provision to pay for her much-needed residential care once she was medically stabilized. Vermont is only willing to pay for one residential program for eating disorders in the state of Virginia. Considering the importance of family involvement in adolescent eating disorder recovery, this wasn't an option for us. I was able to pay for only 2 weeks of residential care at $1,000 a day with a credit card and then bring her home. Marcia, you wrote the book on the Parents' Guide to Eating Disorders. Here's Benjamin talking about what a struggle it was for him to try to get his 12-year-old daughter some help.
And I encourage families in that situation to work with local providers to pull together these teams that can be hard, but once they're together, it's really quite a wonderful phenomenon because it means the child is recovering at home. One of the downsides of intensive programs is that your peer group are other people with eating disorders, and you don't want your child to want to have the best eating disorder. And intensive outpatient and inpatient programs are well aware of that dynamic and work with that, but nevertheless, it is a dynamic. And the ideal situation, in my view, is the child is going to school, is at home, does probably spend some time driving to different appointments, but is able to get her feet on the ground with outpatient, which can be fairly intensive. There are always cases that do need more intense treatment, and it is difficult in Vermont, New Hampshire, that we don't have a lot of options, so we've had to make do.
We got a note from Les who says, when my daughter started to exhibit signs of eating issues, finding medical help was ridiculously difficult. Our primary care physician dismissed me by saying, she's only lost 1 pound. Finding a physiologist to treat a teenager in Bennington was almost impossible. Brattleboro Retreat was suggested, where we were told she wasn't a good fit. The hospital in Bennington eliminated their nutritionist who'd been helpful in recovery. Luckily, Les says, I'm tenacious and well-informed. I'm not sure how people who have less resources at their disposal cope with this very serious illness. And let's go back to the calls. Tracy is on the line from Chelsea. Hi, Tracy. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. I'm happy to be here. I have a comment and a question. I run a little healing arts center, Altus Healing Arts, in Chelsea, which is in central Vermont, and also I practice at the Center for Integrative Health in Hanover, New Hampshire. And I do therapeutic movement and body work with people and help them with a focus on trauma recovery that includes often the co-occurring issues of eating disorders, and helping people discover their body as a feeling, sensing, physical being as opposed to an object that you put clothes on or look at in a mirror is just a miraculous thing to behold and to be part of. And in my own path, I wanted to add, this is, I guess, a question, that when I was a teenager, I fell into a romantic relationship with a teenage boy who was 2 years older than me, who hounded me about not getting fat, about not gaining weight. And I am 5'2 and weigh 108. I am not overweight, and I'm the same size as I was then. And he, I realized, was the one that had the problem, but he hounded me into what I now call a circumstantial eating disorder. I really did develop binge eating habits and so forth. And as soon as I ejected myself out of the relationship, they all went away over time. And I just wanted to ask if Marcia and Bree see that kind of circumstantial eating disorder. Thank you.
Tracy, thanks for the call. Bree, do you see that kind of eating disorder that's often triggered? Tracy said her boyfriend was really pressuring her to eat differently and to lose weight?
Sure. I think it happens, especially in teenagers, because I think teenagers are very vulnerable to what other people think about them. I mean, when you look at really what is the heart of this disorder, you're talking about a strong sense of inadequacy and self-doubt. And so in a teenager, that's appropriate, right? They're still forming their sense of self. As people get older, we expect that they're going to be more grounded in who they are and more confident. But in an eating disorder client or somebody who's struggling with this, that sense of self-doubt pervades throughout their life. And so that dictates a lot of their actions and leaves them very vulnerable to external influences.
Let's go to Mary, who's calling in from Northern Vermont. Hi, Mary. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to comment on two things. One, I was curious of what your viewpoint is on how the public in the medical field view Overeaters Anonymous. I ask that because I've been in Overeaters Anonymous for 11 years, and my sense is that the success of the program isn't very good these days. And same with AA, because AA and OA were intentionally designed to be working just the 12 steps, and there's AA as the fellowship, and then there's AA as the program of recovery working the 12 steps. My own experiences, I was in OA for 11 or 10 years before I really heard what I believe to be the real problem, is that I have an allergy to certain foods that when I ingest them, I just can't stop. My craving is very intense. And then there's also, I have an obsession that keeps convincing me that it's okay to go back to binge eating. And I finally heard that message when I attended, began attending an OWN meeting that works exclusively through the Alcoholics Anonymous Big Book, and finally has been getting recovery. So, yeah, I'm just curious about what you think the medical view is, and then what you think about that program of recovery versus the fellowship, which many see as just a diet with group support.
Mary, thanks for the call. Appreciate that. Mary's had a lot of experience with this, it sounds like. Dr. Herron, can you break it down for us?
Yes, several callers have mentioned OA, Overeaters Anonymous, which is an approach of dealing with food issues that is modeled after AA, and the 12th step and the group support is wonderful. I think for some patients, it's very helpful. In this part of the country, many OA groups approach sugar and maybe even wheat or white flour as an addictive substance. And that's where there can be a conflict with the medical community because there isn't evidence that that's the case. I would say if it is helpful to a patient to avoid those foods, God bless them, and that's wonderful. For many patients, that's not helpful, and I have worked with patients that actually set them up for more binge eating, trying to stay away from foods that they were told were addicting. So it really depends on the person whether that's helpful or not. The group support we cannot offer in other ways, and that's wonderful, and I do have patients that really benefit from the group support in OA and maybe working with me around the food direction of how to manage their food issues.
We got a question from Laura, who writes in to say, I had two 15-year-old girls visiting me recently, and they were sharing with me some concerns they had about a friend who is showing signs of anorexia. What is best for friends to do in this circumstance? And before we end, I'd love to have both of you comment on that, because really, if you suspect somebody of having an eating disorder, what do you do? Brie?
I think if you're a kid and you're a peer, you tell them about your concern. You just tell them from your heart about how you're feeling towards them and how much you care about them. And then you help to let them know that they can get help. And so whether that's encouraging them to go see a school counselor or their physician or tell a parent, you know, I think we've wrongly sometimes encouraged kids to tell their parents, and sometimes parents are very not responsive in a positive way. I think that really sets kids up. So if you're a kid who's got a good friend, I always tell those kids, tell somebody you feel safe with who can help you connect to help.
Dr. Herron, just a couple seconds left. Anything to add to that?
This situation happens all the time, and I have found that school counselors and school nurses could be the person that Bree is talking to that might help the student put their concern into perspective. It's really difficult when a teenager approaches a friend's parents with their concern, and I would agree that may not go as well. Another option is tell your parent about your concern about a friend, particularly if you've expressed concern and you don't see it getting better. We encourage friends not to just sit by and not do more if there hasn't been any kind of turnaround.
Well, difficult topic here, difficult for people who are worried about it among their friends, and difficult for so many people who are trying to deal with disordered eating, whether it reaches the level of an actual labeled eating disorder or not. I appreciate both of you shining a light on this, sort of lifting the curtain on something that so many people deal with. Thank you very much for your time, Bree Greenberg-Benjamin and Dr. Marcia Herron. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bree Greenberg-Benjamin is the founder and director of the Vermont Center for Integrative Therapy in South Burlington. Dr. Marcia Herron is the author of The Parent's Guide to Eating Disorders. She also has a private practice treating eating disorders in Lebanon, New Hampshire, and founded the Dartmouth College Eating Disorders Prevention, Education, and Treatment Program. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Amish life is more than just plain dress, a Germanic dialect, and an aversion to modern technology. It's also an insular faith which demands that adherents live, worship, and marry within the community. Those strict expectations, along with a troubled home life, were too much for one Ohio Amish woman. Saloma Miller Furlong was 20 years old in the 1970s when she first ran away from her Amish community in Ohio and sought refuge in Burlington, Vermont. It's a story that she tells in her new memoir, Bonnet Strings, An Amish Woman's Ties to Two Worlds. Saloma Miller Furlong shared her experience with VPR's Patty Daniels.
Your book begins with reflections on the tension you felt between the importance of Amish community cohesion and your own desire for individual freedom. What do you mean when you say that you and Amish culture were a mismatch from the start?
Well, in order to be a good Amish person, it's basically measured by how well you fit into the group. Because in the Amish culture, community is the most important. It's not the family and it's not the individual, it's the community. So for me, I could not, no matter how hard I tried, I could not tamp down the questions that just kept boiling right up from within me. And my mother used to say to me, "Oh, Saloma, if you only knew how much better off you are without asking those questions, maybe you'd stop asking them."
What kinds of questions were you asking?
Things like, why can't we have bicycles, but we can ride in somebody else's car? Why can't we have a Christmas tree like the Sikoras across the street? Why can't we take pictures in school? And then later on, as I got older, I would ask things like, if God really doesn't want people to ask questions, then why did he give me such an inquisitive nature? And those were just questions that the Amish could not or would not answer. And so having that curious, feisty, adventurous spirit that I had from the start just did not fit into a community where the women and the girls are expected to be demure and quiet and submissive.
So in 1978, when you are 20 years old, you do decide to leave in secret with the help of a neighbor, and Vermont is your destination. Why Vermont?
Well, because when I was in seventh grade, I fell in love with New England and certainly Vermont. I did indeed subscribe to Vermont Life magazine, and they were literally my lifeline because I would put myself into those pictures, and I had escaped to Vermont in my mind long before I actually did it.
The Chamber of Commerce would be thrilled to know that.
It was actually the Chamber of Commerce I called. When I was looking for a place to stay, I called the Vermont Chamber of Commerce and asked where in the state I could find a residential YWCA. The only one in the state of Vermont was in Burlington. So that's how I ended up in Burlington.
And when you get there, you change your name to Linda. And pretty quickly, you form a lot of friendships that you feel like you never had in Burton, Ohio. What was that like for you?
It was amazing. It was it was as if I was becoming the person I was meant to be. And especially when I met David, it's like the little romance we had going was really amazing. We dined in the restaurants and we danced in the bars and all of those things. And then we also like to go out and drive into the country and just talk for hours.
And it won't be a spoiler alert because we know your last name. You do eventually marry David, but it is quite a long road to get
yes,
to that point.
Is. I know.
While you're building this new life in Burlington, you are pretty preoccupied with the idea of whether you'll actually go back and resume your Amish life. What were you torn with then?
Well, it's basically impossible to replace the community we left. And so we have to choose between family and community and freedom. That's a pretty tough choice. You know, there's also the faith community that you lose. And there is a really deep and abiding faith that the Amish live out. It's a quiet faith. It's one that's a lived faith. And leaving that belonging and tradition and community behind was hard.
And partly it was hard because you are receiving letters and phone calls from
yes.
your community in Ohio, insisting, begging, cajoling, guilting you into
yeah.
trying to come back.
Yes. Yeah, the guilt is one of the things that is the more punitive parts of their culture and religion. And yes, that also played on my psyche as well. It wasn't just the longing for community, but it was also the constant reminder that you promised on bended knee that you will stay with the Amish culture the rest of your life, and here you are breaking your promise. So there was that too.
So for about 4 months in the winter of 77 and 78, you are in Burlington trying to establish this new life, having all of these difficult thoughts about what you've left behind. And then totally unexpectedly, your brother and sister show up with a van full of powerful members of your church, and they insist that you come home with them. And they had actually tried once before to do this, but you hid.
Mm-hmm.
This time, it seems like you agree pretty easily that you're going to go back home to Ohio.
Well, with the bishop and his wife in the van, my uncle, who had a lot of sway in the community, my older brother, who was used to forcing us sisters to do whatever he thought was right, I did not want to find out if they would stuff me into the van physically.
Hmm.
The thing is, from the moment that I saw my sister's dress outside, I felt like I was a puppet on a string. It felt like I had no choice. And then when I found out who was in the van, I just completely gave up. It was as if they had brought the community to my Vermont world, and I had to choose.
When you got back to Ohio, how were you regarded by the community?
Very cautiously. I think there was a lot of curiosity about what I had experienced, but very few people expressed that. On the one hand, people seemed to kind of tiptoe around me and not want to upset me. And on the other hand, I was being criticized publicly.
And while that's going on publicly in your community, you're kind of maintaining this personal, private relationship with your friends in Vermont through letters.
Yes.
And in particular, you write a lot of letters with your friend Barbara LaLancet and also on and off with David.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about what that letter writing connection meant to you.
With Barbara, it was absolutely my lifeline because Barbara was a very astute friend. She understood sort of what was going on with me internally. And I wrote a lot of things to her that I didn't even write into my journal at the time because I knew my journal could be found and read. Once that letter was off to Barbara, it was in safe hands. And so There were times when I would just literally pour my heart out to Barbara. And getting letters back from her was absolutely what I lived for at the time. Because it gave me that link to my Vermont world and freedom.
Barbara wasn't the only one writing
yes,
to you.
I know.
David was persistent.
Yes, he was.
And what you and David both talk about and sort of diagnose later on is that you were really fighting yourself to put on a show of, I am going to be Amish.
Yes.
And I am going to make this work.
I am going to make myself Amish. That is the attitude I had. And I, you know, I was really getting a lot of pressure from the Amish, especially after David's first visit, which was a friendly visit. And he had asked for a hug and a kiss that day, and I'd only allowed him a handshake. And then I wasn't so sure that I could stay just friends with David. And then when he was pushing on one end and the Amish were pushing on the other end, I was trying to figure out where I fit in all of this.
David gently reappears in your life, again through letters, and by Christmas 1979, 2 years after you first met, you realize that you do want to be with him.
Right.
What is that realization like for you after all that fight?
Yes, well, you know what it was? It was partly the card he sent me. And on the inside of the card, the message started out, all living things respond to the warmth of love. And I remember just about melting. He had also sent me a Vermont Life calendar with gorgeous pictures of Vermont. He knew exactly how to bring the nostalgia on for Vermont. And I was thinking to myself, if he was here with me now, I would give him that hug and I would never let him go. And it was that moment that I said, God, if David and I are meant to be together, then please help me find my way back to him. And that was my moment of when my mind started changing, because the longing to be with him outweighed my desire to make it in my Amish community.
And it does take several months of sort of rebuilding that relationship with him before this seems like an opportunity that you actually might be leaving. It's almost like you're privately preparing yourself for that possibility again.
Yes.
And then you do visit David in Vermont in the fall of 1980. What clarity did that trip bring to you?
That was really the week that David and I realized either he had to join the Amish or I had to leave. And he was actually willing to join the Amish. And I remember breaking down in tears and saying, what I want is to be where people understand me. And I felt at that moment a clarity that I hadn't felt before. Yes, the Amish have that sense of community and belonging, but there's a different kind of belonging that comes with being where people do understand you.
You and David make plans that you are going to leave Ohio for good.
Mm-hmm.
And you go back to say goodbyes to your family and to sort of pack up your life. And while you're home in Ohio, you have some really intense conversations with your sisters about salvation and what it means that you're leaving the church. What were they worried about for you?
As we are growing up, from the time we can understand the concept, we're taught that because God had us be born Amish, he wanted us to stay Amish, and if we left, then all hope of our salvation would be lost. And I was calling that belief into question. I did not believe that that was the case, and my sisters still were afraid of that. For all people who leave the Amish, they have to come to terms with that part of the Amish belief system. And my sisters were not there yet.
Your new memoir that we've been discussing really is a laser focus on those 2 to 3 years of your life where you're making this decision between being Amish and not being Amish, between being in Ohio and being in Vermont. Part of your struggle is that the elders in your church had told you, you either are or aren't Amish, and you were really fighting to try to find a way to be both.
Right.
How did your spiritual journey evolve after leaving the church? Were you able to answer that question for yourself?
You know, at first I felt like, well, you know, they're wrong, because there's always a part of me that will be Amish, but I don't have to put up with the restrictions of Amish life. But then, somewhere along the line, I realized, you know what? The Amish are right. You cannot have it both ways. When we make choices in life, sometimes there are other choices that are not available to us anymore. And when we leave the Amish, we are leaving a community and a way of life that we cannot replace in the mainstream culture. And so I think that the Amish are actually right. You really cannot have it both ways.
Saloma Miller Furlong, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you, Patty. It has been a great pleasure.
That's writer Saloma Miller Furlong speaking with Vermont Edition's managing producer, Patty Daniels. Furlong's new memoir is called Bonnet Strings, An Amish Woman's Ties to Two Worlds. That's it for today. Now, whether or not the sap is running, we'll be sugaring. We're going to have a look at how maple sugaring has changed through the centuries tomorrow on the program. Our producers are Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistants from Tim Johnson and Devin Karambalis. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen.